The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to Audio Journal's Mindful Moments program. You'll hear articles from Spirit of Change magazine. I'm Jillian, and for the next half hour, we'll explore Hantavirus, a cruise ship, a deer mouse, and the fictional line between human and animal health. Boost your immunity with fermented garlic honey. And last, how to limit antibiotic damage and tips to rebuild your gut. Let's begin with Hantavirus, a cruise ship, a deer mouse, and the fictional line between human and animal health. In February 2025, the classical pianist Betsy Arakawa died in her New Mexico home from a virus most people had never heard of. Her husband, the actor Gene Hackman, died a week later of heart disease. The pathogen that killed her was Hantavirus, almost certainly picked up from deer mouse dropping on the property. 14 months later, 11 people on a Dutch cruise ship, Hondius, have been infected with a different Hantavirus strain. Three have died, and passengers from more than 20 countries have been monitored across four continents. This is not the next pandemic, but it is a stress test and a reminder of something we keep relearning the hard way. When humans push into ecosystems that don't normally inhabit, they are exposed to viruses. Ebola in West Africa in 2014 followed deforestation and closer contact with bats. By the time the outbreak began, more than 80% of the surrounding forests had been cleared. This Hantavirus outbreak is a smaller, slower-moving version of the same lesson. The line between human health and animal health and the place we travel for pleasure is much smaller than we like to think. Hantaviruses, not one virus, but a family of related viruses, carried by different rodent species in different parts of the world. The strain found in Canada carried by deer mice, Cinnobre virus, is the same one that killed Arakawa and is behind the 168 Canadian cases of Hantavirus pulmonary syndrome documented in 1994. The strain on the Hondius is different. Andes virus, found in South America, is the only Hantavirus known to spread between people and through close interpersonal contact. A New England Journal of Medicine study of a 2018 Andes outbreak reconstructed how a single zoonotic spillover from a rodent reservoir in Argentina produced 34 human cases and 11 deaths over 3 months, driven by three symptomatic super spreaders at crowded social events. A cruise ship with a confined cabin, shared dining rooms, and recirculated air, a floating petri dish, is exactly the setting where a virus with limited contagion can find unexpected runway. The first confirmed case on board, likely the index case though not lab confirmed, had spent 4 months on a bird-watching trip through South America before boarding with possible exposure to rodents. Though much of the focus has been to reassure people that this is not the next COVID-19, what this outbreak points to is a real-time One Health story, a framework that recognizes human, animal, and environmental health as a single interconnected system. Hantaviruses do not begin in hospitals or airports. They circulate in animal reservoirs, whose ranges are shaped by climate, land use, and human encroachment. Deer mouse populations in North America boomed roughly tenfold following the wet, warm El Nino winter of 1991 to 1992, triggering the 1993 Hantavirus outbreak. The ecology of Andes virus in Patagonia is itself shifting. Modeling work suggests the long-tailed rodent that carries the virus may see its range contract and move eastward under continued warming and drying, redistributing rather than eliminating spillover risk. The same dynamic plays out elsewhere. In Southeast Asia, for example, rodent trade networks, deforestations, and intensifying agriculture continually create new interfaces between people and pathogens, and these same forces are reshaping disease risk closer to home. Lyme disease has been creeping steadily north into a warming winter's expand. The range of the black-legged tick, the mosquitoes that carry dengue, Zika, and chikungunya are doing the same across Europe and North America. All pathogens have more opportunities to expand and interact with humankind. All of this is being amplified by how we now travel. Antarctic and expedition bookings are up 34% year on year. Last chance tourism into fragile and isolated ecosystems, wildlife photography in remote habitats, cruises that promise experiences into uninhabited shores. This is a growing category of travel, despite being potential One Health exposures. The response to this outbreak also revealed how brittle our systems remain. A passenger died on April 11th. Hantavirus was not identified until May 2nd. 3 weeks during which the ship continued its route calling at multiple ports. The World Health Organization, WHO, own 2016 Handbook of Managing Public Health Events on Board Ships, calls for an all-hazards precautionary approach when a cause cannot be identified. It was not applied. When the ship later approached land, Cape Verde was deemed unable to handle the emergency, and Spain ultimately accepted it, citing a moral obligation. The international health regulations, the legal scaffolding of events like this, give the WHO almost no authority to enforce them. Cooperations run on goodwill, which is quite thin when an infected vessel needs a port. Meanwhile, social media filled gaps with conspiracy theories about engineered pathogens and scripted pandemics, a familiar pattern in which public anxiety fueled by uncertainty becomes a vector of its own. For the public, the practical message is unchanged. Ventilate closed spaces before entering. Wet contaminated surfaces before cleaning. Never dry sweep rodent droppings. But there is a deeper lesson here. Betsy Arakawa died from a deer mouse in her own home. Passengers on the Hondius may have been infected by rodents in the Patagonian dump. Investigators are still working it out. But what connects these stories is a world where the boundaries between human health, animal health, climate, and travel are largely fictional and shrinking further every year. Ultimately, this is a stress test for us. We have learned from past crises, and our response is faster and more coordinated than it would have been a decade ago. But the Hondius shows us how much further we have to go for stronger international agreements that share information in real time, for the 2025 WHO pandemic agreement to actually function, and for better spillover monitoring that catches the big one early. The next article is Boost Your Immunity with Fermented Garlic Honey. Garlic honey may not make your mouth water with anticipation, but once you read about its powerful health benefits, you may decide it's worth a taste. Independent of each other, both honey and garlic contain powerful antioxidants that help keep your body's immune system strong, as well as boost your brain health, protecting it from inflammatory-based diseases such as dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Garlic has also been shown to be beneficial towards heart health by lowering blood pressure, cholesterol, and preventing clotting in blood vessels. When combined, their antibacterial, antiviral, and immune-boosting properties make this powerhouse duo a worthy combatant of flourishing cold and flu germs. Once fermented, the shelf life and versatility make this unlikely combo even more appealing. Best of all, these two superfruits can quickly be married together in a simple process needing only two ingredients and a jar. Honey antimicrobial properties make it an unlikely medium for fermentation. However, the garlic juices allow the fermentation magic to happen. Your end result is garlic that is sweetened and mellowed. Two ingredients is all that it takes. Making fermented garlic honey is uncomplicated and merely requires honey and garlic. Start with 1 cup of peeled garlic, the fresher the better, lightly crushed, but don't smash each clove with the side of a chef's knife or chop large cloves in halves to release a bit of juices from the garlic, which will help thin the honey. Lightly crushing each clove allows the honey to penetrate them more easily, aiding in the fermentation process. Don't forget to save those nutritious garlic peel to throw into your favorite homemade broth. Add the prepared garlic to a clean glass jar that has a lid. Pour 1 to 1.5 cups of raw, unpasteurized honey over the garlic, just enough to completely cover the garlic and not much more. Using too much may prevent your mixture from reaching the moisture content needed for fermentation to begin. Be sure to use raw honey as pasteurizations kill off the microbes needing for fermentation. The small amount of juice released from the garlic will jumpstart the fermentation process in the honey. Cover your jar with a lid and place it in a dark place to ferment. Place a plate under your jar as it ferments, as it will bubble up and could potentially drip out. Over the course of the next couple of weeks, you will need to burp your jar daily. Open the lid to release any buildup of gases. Then, close and gently turn your jar over to ensure all the garlic stays coated with honey. Be quick while opening the lid to prevent too much oxygen from being introduced during the fermentation process, just quick enough to release gases. In a few days to a week, you will notice bubbles forming on the surface of the honey. The honey garlic will ferment for about a month. But you can dig into your jar at any time after 1 week. Over the time, the flavor will continue to develop. The garlic will mellow and the honey will become runnier. It is normal for the honey and garlic to darken, but don't be alarmed if the garlic cloves turn a blue or green hue. This is a normal reaction due to the fermentation process. The discolored garlic is safe to consume. Store your honey, fermented garlic in a cool, dark place away from direct sunlight. A kitchen cupboard or a pantry is the perfect home. As long as it is stored in an airtight container and no moisture can creep in, it can last for months or even years. If you don't use it often, your jar may need an occasional burping to release the buildup gases, although this will slow down over time. Fermented garlic honey can be used in plethora of ways. When you feel a cold or flu setting in, pop a whole clove or take a spoonful of honey, or both. Garlic honey also boasts well in marinades and sauces, making a tasty glaze for meats, veggies, or basically anything you would normally use honey or garlic for. Drizzle over pizza, serve alongside, or use a glaze for your favorite protein friend, chicken, grilled chicken, pork, shrimp, or tofu. Drizzle over cheese, warm brie, goat cheese, or ricotta. Use in a salad dressing or marinades. Spread the honey over toasty cornbread, pretzels, breakfast, muffins, or toast. Pour some over roasted or stir-fry veggies. Use the mellow garlic in dips like hummus or a white bean dip. The uses and ideas are really endless. Note of caution. Though the risk is minimal, some methods of preserving garlic run the risk of carrying botulism. However, with this method, the acidity in the honey makes it improbable for bacteria to survive and multiply, which is why honey has such a significant stable shelf life. If you are concerned about botulism, you can ease your mind by testing with a pH strip. Botulism cannot grow in acidic conditions. With a pH less than 4.6, honey contains many kinds of acids, and its pH runs around 3.9, varying between brands. If your pH is too high, try adding a splash of apple cider vinegar to add more acidity, and then retest. As always, avoid giving honey to babies under the age of one. The last article, How to Limit Antibiotic Damage and Tips to Rebuild Your Gut. Most people assume antibiotics do their job and leave no trace. A short course, a quick recovery, and life goes on. But emerging research tells a very different story. A large-scale study published in Nature Medicine reveals that a single course of antibiotics leaves a measurable imprint on your gut microbiome that persists for years, not weeks. Your gut microbiome, the trillions of bacteria lining your digestive tract, doesn't just help you digest food. It plays a role in metabolic regulation, immune development, and processes ranging from inflammatory to blood sugar control. When that system gets disrupted, the consequences ripple outward in ways many people don't connect back to the prescription they took years earlier. Changes in how you process food, how your body manages inflammation, and how well your immune system holds up under pressure. The findings challenge a basic assumption that your body simply bounces back. The Nature Medicine study analyzed data from 14,979 adults in Sweden to understand how antibiotic use affects the gut microbiome over time. Researchers combined prescription records and advanced stool analysis to measure changes in gut bacteria across an 8-year period. This gave them a long-term view of what actually happened after you take antibiotics, not just days or weeks later, but years down the line. While your gut begins recovering soon after antibiotic exposure, the study revealed that recovery slows significantly over time. Most of the rebound happens in the first 2 years, after which progress becomes much slower. This explains why long-term differences remain detectable even 8 years later. Different antibiotics create very different levels of disruption. Drugs like clindamycin, fluoroquinolones, and flucloxacillin were associated with the most significant and long-lasting changes, reducing dozens of bacterial species at once. More commonly used antibiotics like penicillin V have a smaller impact. The broader and stronger the antibiotic, the deeper the disruption inside your gut. Understanding the damage is only useful if it points you toward what actually helps your gut recover. Microbial diversity often does not fully rebuild on its own, and dietary inputs may play an important role in supporting recovery. Your gut bacteria need specific raw materials from food to recolonize and regain their functional roles. Different species thrive on different substrates, fibers, polyphenols, and resistant starches, which is why dietary variety matters as much as dietary quality. At the same time, food associated with inflammation or gut barrier stress may also may also slow the process, creating an environment where the wrong species gain ground while the beneficial ones struggle to return. That's the logic behind every step that follows. Remove what interferes with recovery, then supply your bacteria need to rebuild. Number one, use antibiotics only when they're truly necessary. If you reach for antibiotics every time you get a cough, sore throat, or sinus flare, pause before you do that again. Many of those illnesses are viral, and antibiotics do nothing for viruses. What they do accomplish is another blow to your gut ecosystem. Your first step is to treat antibiotics as a last resort, not a reflex. That single shift helps preserve bacterial species that contribute to digestion, inflammation balance, and recovery. Number two, cut off the background exposure from conventional meat. If your meals rely on cheap fast food meat, grocery store deli meat, or conventionally raised chicken, pork, or beef, your gut faces a steady trickle of antibiotic residues from that food supply. To reduce your exposure, choose pasture-raised or organic meat so your microbiome isn't subjected to low-dose antibiotic exposure day after day. Three, use natural antibacterial options for mild problems. For mild issues, natural antibacterial options like medicinal honey and oregano oil have been explored as alternatives for mild issues, with less impact on microbial balance. These may offer an alternative approach for minor issues when antibiotics aren't medically necessary. That matters because every time you avoid an unnecessary antibiotic, you preserve more of your bacterial species your gut needs. Think of it as protecting your internal reserves instead of draining them again. It's also worth remembering what I believe is the best way to ease upper respiratory infections: nebulize hydrogen peroxide. Many make the mistake of taking antibiotics for upper respiratory infections unnecessarily. But because most URIs are viral, antibiotics typically aren't effective for these cases. 4. Remove the foods and fats that keep your gut barrier irritated. Your gut doesn't recover well on ultra-processed food, refined snacks, and seed oils high in linoleic acid. Your gut lining depends on healthy, stable cell membranes to repair itself after antibiotic damage, and the fats you eat directly shape those membranes. Excessive LA intake alters cellular membranes and interferes with mitochondrial function. So if your pantry is full of chips, packed grain products, frozen meals, and restaurant food cooked in soybean, corn, canola, or sunflower oil, start there. Replace those foods with simple meals cooked in grass-fed butter, ghee, or tallow. Your goal is to lower LA intake below 5 grams a day, and closer to 2 grams if possible. Typical meals might include pastured eggs. Cook in butter, white rice with slow-cooked grass-fed beef, and whole fruit. That gives your gut lining stable fuel instead of more disruption. 5. Rebuild your carb and fiber tolerance in the right order. If your digestion is already struggling, bloating, post-meal fatigue, unpredictable bowel habits, loading up on fiber is likely to make things worse before they get better. The goal of this rebuilding process is to help your gut bacteria produce butyrate, a short-chain fatty acid that serves as a key fuel source for cells lining your colon. Without enough butyrate, those cells can weaken, your gut barrier may become more permeable, and inflammation may spread more easily into the rest of your body. But your bacteria can only make butyrate when they have the right raw materials. And The means reintroducing fiber in a sequence your gut can handle. Start with easy-to-digest foods such as whole food and white rice, so your body gets the glucose it needs for cellular energy. Once your digestion settles, add fiber slowly. Root vegetables first, then non-starchy vegetables, then starchier plants like squash or sweet potatoes. Later, if you tolerate them well, add beans, legumes, and minimally processed whole grains. Mindful Moments is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program, scheduled either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Jillian. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is Bird Note. Molly Adams founded the Feminist Bird Club to try to make birding safer and more inclusive.
Birders who are Black, visibly disabled, and queer are going to face challenges while birding that cisgender, able-bodied white people do not. And our goal is to reduce these obstacles.
Along with co-author Sydney Golden Anderson, Molly wrote a book titled Birding for a Better World that welcomes newcomers to birding and offers ways to make events more inclusive and accessible.
We hope that this book encourages organizers to consider what needs they might not already be meeting and find ways to accommodate them. Throughout the book, you'll see a lot of suggestions from other birding organizations and ways that organizers can look to their own members and other groups in their community.
The book also debunks some myths that can scare people away from birding, Sydney says.
Birding does not necessarily mean bird walk. In fact, you don't have to walk at all while birding. Birding is for all people of all ages and abilities. You don't have to have fancy equipment to begin birding. And yes, you're a birder, even if you're a beginner.
What's more, Sydney says that birding can help improve our world.
Birding with mindfulness can be a profoundly healing practice that can help one redevelop a sense of interconnectivity with nature. How to just be there and coexist and do so in a way that's sustainable and gentle and careful and reciprocal.
Learn more about the book on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Everyone knows that both Christmas Day and New Year's Day always fall on the same day of the week. However, in 1939, the year of the outbreak of World War II, Christmas fell on a Monday, and New Year's fell on a Sunday. Why?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
The key to the solution is the year. In a single year, Christmas Day and New Year's Day always fall on different days of the week. In 1939, New Year's Day fell on a Sunday. Some 51 weeks later, still in that same year, Christmas Day fell on a Monday. A week later, in 1940, New Year's also fell on a Monday.
And now back to our regular programming.
People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team. And at the Mass Commission for the Blind, we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.